I don't necessarily think you're a narcissist, but you are very full of yourself. And I will like to say this is that
I do like being a little bit of a center of attention, I'm not going to lie. You can't be a litigator, a true litigator, without some level of wanting to be the center of attention. You just can't. You know, Jake, I'm a little disappointed in your lack of involvement in my life. I really expected better at this point.
What are some of the things you've never shared here before that you'd like to share now, just to fill time on the segment?
Oh, Jake, I hate you. The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Raw.
So, you are a family law attorney.
Yep.
You deal with divorce pretty much every day.
Yes.
You deal with infidelity.
I wouldn't say every day, but close.
What do you feel is probably the best way to not sort of get jaded by the work that you do? Because it's very easy for you, ingesting all these things, to not only have safety guards, but to really have a skewed vision when it comes to trust, boundaries, and love.
There's a real risk that you run doing what I do for a living of getting jaded, because we see the underbelly, so to speak, of relationships, and we see the underbelly of the breakdown of relationships. And it's a little bit of like losing the forest from the trees. Like, I see the really ugly. Like, as a general rule, I don't get the, we're going to get along and agree on the terms of our divorce. When my clients get to the, we agree to the terms of the divorce, it's usually after court hearings and some proverbial bloodshed and some proverbial burning of bridges and pointing of fingers. And it's not, most often it is not everyone gets along to resolve it efficiently and reasonably. I have some that do that, but I would say that's probably 25% of my cases versus the other 75% that want to punch the other side's teeth in. So it's difficult not to get jaded. And so I definitely have, and you know, now that I'm back out there, right? Because now that I'm divorced, and I've been divorced now for almost 2 years, I look at the dating world and I'm like, no, thanks. Because the red flags for me, like, I see a red flag in about everything and in about everyone, which is probably unfair for me, because just because it's is a red flag in and of itself, it may not be a red flag, right? If you look at the totality of the circumstances, it may not be a red flag. But I don't know. I still believe in love. I still believe in true love. I still believe that there can be a person for you, although I think who your person is changes over time. I don't think who your person is when you're 25 is the same person when you're 50. So anyways, did I even come close to answering the question?
You did, but how come I was searching for research studies, Austin area for Hinge last night, and I saw Love Lockett?
Not
77
me.
Last night? Is that you?
Not me. Nope.
Okay. Somebody, okay. Look just like you. Women make the first move on Hinge. So you are more apt to Hinge, to be fair. You are someone who, oddly enough, gets somewhat, not really uncomfortable, but confused when men approach you. Like, you don't understand it. You don't comprehend it. I don't know what language it's in, but it certainly doesn't calculate in your brain.
It's usually, I'm like, why are you talking to me?
Yeah, you know, no, it's almost like it's anything but they could be attracted to you.
Correct.
That's literally how you take things.
That is 100% correct. That is, they're interested in me in some romantic fashion is the last idea to ever go through my brain until someone's like, duh. I'm like, how'd you miss it? I'm like when I've sent you a couple pictures that I've gotten and you're like, Michelle. I'm like, really?
Next time you get approached, I want you to go through and log every single potential scenario of why you think a gentleman is talking to you or approaching you. And I would love to hear these things because I see a very fun path to discuss. Like, maybe he wants help on changing his oil. Maybe he needs a jump start. Maybe he needs a discount code to something. Maybe he needs parenting tips. Maybe he, like, I would love to hear what's going on in your brain. I'd love an output on
it. It would usually be that, because I'm telling you, my go-to is definitely not that they're interested in me. It's usually like they need something. I can help with something. And with my brain and the squirrels that go through it, the last thing that ever enters my mind is, oh, they're interested in me. Like, I mean, for the most part, I didn't even think about that. I didn't even register.
And it's a weird, it's like, huh, that's weird. That's strange. Yeah, like there's a little bit of like.
Well, then I think I'm like, they're interested. I'm like, what's wrong with them? It's usually my go-to. I'm like, oh, why, what do you want? Because like, not me. I mean, it may be me, but not for like the romantic things. It's for everything else.
Yeah. Utility things. Utility. You know, like maybe they need help moving a bookshelf or something.
Yeah, because I'm so good at moving things. You know, people call me. I can't tell you the last time I got a phone call, other than like some select few people, but like you. Call them just to check in. I can tell you about every phone call I get, where at least 90, 95% of them are like, hey, I have a question. Hey, I need something. Not a, hey, how are you doing? And I had a couple of those phone calls earlier this week where it was, hey, I need help. Hey, I need help. Hey, I need help. And I look, I'm like, I'm not answering. I'm not answering today.
Here's a rule of thumb. If somebody approaches you and they are direct, okay, they are direct with, I need A plus B equals C.
Okay.
I need you to X, Y, Z. If they have a very, let's say, a very sharp target with what their request is and what they're wanting or needing from you.
Okay.
But if there's a little bit of a murkiness, if there's a little bit of small talk, if there's a little bit of things that are less clear, there's probably a good shot that that man is potentially just fishing for potential mutual interest and seeing where you're at in your life and if they could be somebody who could fit into that life of yours.
I want to give some men some insight.
Please do.
And this may not work for every woman. I'm just saying it works for me. Don't beat around the bush. I say don't beat around the bush for lots of reasons. That being said, just come up and say, Michelle, I think you're stunning. I think you're hilarious. I would love to hang out with you some more. Just be direct. Small talk with me is like the dead register.
We recently did an episode with Lauren LaRusso.
We did.
And she is a coach. She is someone who deals with people who have gone through affairs, usually in marriages, right? What are some of the things that you took away from that episode? What did you learn from Lauren's wisdom?
She changed my attitude a little bit on It Takes Two. And she was very direct and blunt about that, which I appreciated, right? I am never one of those people that is so stuck in my position that I'm not willing to listen to someone else's beliefs, logics, or explanation, right? I'm just not. I mean, I can always be wrong. And when I listened to her explain it, I was like, yeah. Because the bottom line, it comes down to the act, right? And it takes one person to engage in that specific act of betrayal. And for everyone, that act of betrayal can be different, right? And that's one of the things we talked about when we were with her is every relationship is different. There's no one norm on what is cheating or not. What I thought was really interesting is she has the same viewpoint that I do on cell phone passcodes. Like, that to me was really not what I expected her to say at all. And when she said, she's like, yeah, there's no reason to have it. I think she used her own personal example. And when she said that, I was like, yes, because that's my belief too. Is if you have to go through your partner's phone, something's wrong. Now, if it's, hey, sweetheart, will you pull up the tickets for the movie on the phone? Right. Okay. That's something totally different. But if you are going through your partner's phone actively looking for evidence that they have done something wrong, she's right. That's a moment where you need to stop and get your partner and say, let's have a sit-down conversation and talk about where things have gone wrong. Because you can't live your life under a microscope like that. I know I didn't. It is misery.
if I can't trust my partner with my phone passcode, I should not be with that partner. That's my logic.
Well, so you are, then you disagree. Like, you think that your partner should have your passcode.
I think for emergency purposes and for anything else, depending upon the, I guess, degree of the relationship, like how far along you are. But I've been in situations where if I've ever been in a situation where I couldn't trust my partner with my phone, okay, then I shouldn't be with that partner. I don't want a partner who actively searches, because that means they don't trust me. Right. And they don't take my word for what I do or do not do with my phone, how I communicate with people in the outside world. So that's what I'm getting to, is I don't think technically that a partner has right to your passcode. But I personally feel that if I can't trust them with that, then it's probably not going to be a good partnership for me.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I don't have a problem with them having access to it. I think it's the act of going through it and just searching for evidence. And like, if you are literally waiting for your spouse, your partner, to get in the shower so you can go through their devices, you need to stop. Like, there's
that's just wrong. Well, that's flaws in the relationship.
But it happens.
Well, I think this is that. What is the reason behind wanting the passcode? Like, for me, if my partner asks me for my passcode, that's one thing. If I give that to them, that's another thing. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
So I think that I'm probably looking at it more from a safety standpoint, to be fair, because normally you would think like, no, I should keep all my stuff private. But what if, God forbid, there's some medical emergency? What if there's some need to get information from there? That to me would be a win. But at the same point, no, I don't believe that. So, because that means that if I say nothing is going on, there's no problems, I'm not communicating with somebody, and they don't take my word for it, and they want my passcode so they can go through my phone, obviously that's a violation of boundaries. That's a violation of trust. And so there's bigger problems in the relationship than just access.
Okay. So then here's the question. Do you believe that within the confines of a relationship that each individual partner has a reasonable expectation of privacy?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I agree too.
I think privacy is paramount in many ways. I think that, but privacy comes with a level of respect, a level of understanding and fulfilling boundaries. And the unfortunate thing is this: a lot of times when we get into relationships because of that sort of, you know, love chemical, that sort of, you know, lust, whatever you want to call it, is that we make decisions. Exactly. We make decisions that are not necessarily effective for how we would conduct our life outside of the relationship, but we do things and pacify things and make certain concessions because of that chemical, because of that feeling. And I found myself in many of those situations too. I've went against my instincts about trust, about conversations, about things that I didn't feel right about, but I went ahead with because I didn't want to cause friction. I didn't want to cause any problems between my partner and I. And, and you know, when she was doing something that I didn't necessarily agree with, or I felt a little bit violated by, I just said, well, maybe I'm being too sensitive here. Maybe I should just let this go.
And so he's like, can I ask you a question? And I'm like, sure. And he said, was this act creepy? And I'm like, okay, tell me what the facts are. He's like, well, I met this girl. Well, I'm sorry. He knew this girl and they hung out recently and they made out, whatever, when they hung out for that particular time. Mm-hmm. And he's known her for several years, but she got the flu real badly and was in bed. And they were talking on the phone a couple days ago and she was telling him how she wanted this particular like milkshake thing from this particular place. And she was really, really sick yesterday. So he's like, I had nothing else to do. He's like, so I went and picked up exactly what she told me she liked and put it on her front porch. He's like, is that creepy? And I was like, no. I said, there's a caveat to that. I said, wait for her response and then go from there. I said, most women will think that's really sweet because he not just only listen to me, he heard me, right? I said, but if she doesn't respond, and then go away quietly.
That's great advice. But I gotta tell you, there was an era where the sort of the mystery Cyrano de Bergerac was actually a really good thing, or at least it was a engaging thing, not just in movies and TV, but in real life. And yeah. I think what's happened is that we're so used to people not respecting boundaries and not understanding the level of privacy and consent. And that is a real problem because, you know, you think of this, you know, the roses on the car or things like that, secret admirer stuff, right?
Secret admirer.
Well, no, but secret admirer is like, I hate to say it like this, but oftentimes gets mixed up with stalking, unfortunately.
Oh, well,
and,
yeah.
And so you want to know sort of the chain of title when it comes to gifts, when it comes to little affectionate things most of the time. Like,
of custody. Like, this is...
I don't hear many women nowadays like those kind of surprises. I got to be honest with you. And granted, maybe I'm jaded because of the stories that I hear, but I don't hear a lot of women say, somebody gave me roses and I don't know who they were from, but I'm really excited to know. That almost never happens in my world.
Okay, I agree. But your world's like my world. We don't hear the good shit.
No. What are some of the things you've never shared here before that you'd like to share now, just to fill time on the segment?
Oh, Jake, I hate you.
Our questions are different, and I'll tell you why. Okay? You are a lawyer. You're someone who needs facts immediately.
Yes.
You need information. You do not have time in a courtroom to get into somebody's feelings and their psyche. I do the opposite. I want to get into sort of the weeds when it comes to more conversation things that give people time to pause and think. You don't need people to pause and think. You just need answers.
Well, because if you give them time to pause and think, then the truth doesn't come out.
What does enjoying your blonde life mean?
Oh, blondes do have fun. Can I tell you, and I'm in this, so I'm brunette. Like if you look at my pictures from my kid, like I have brown hair. I don't have so much brown hair anymore because I'm older and it's gray and I refuse to go gray. So it's going to be blonde. It's easier to maintain. It has changed how people approach me. It has changed how people talk to me. I hate to say blondes have more fun, but man, I will never go back to dark hair.
How did being a blonde impact your career, if at all?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I have a few.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I don't know that it's changed my career within the courtroom. I don't know that it's changed that. That being said, there is a difference in looks. And so whether people want to admit it or not, the more attractive you are, the more believable you at times become, the more marketable you become. In some regards, you're willing to get out there and stop sitting on the sidelines. I know for me, my change in appearance and my shit over 120 pound weight loss now has really gotten me off the sidelines and I have a confidence now that I haven't had in a very, very long time. And it's really nice to have that confidence and not have that, like I was always hiding underneath clothes or hiding behind clothes. And it's really nice. And so whether it's the blonde, whether it's the losing all the weight, whatever it is, I am loving this version of me. And it's probably the first time in my life where I've really like been okay with really who I am and just happy. Like I walk around, I'm like, I'm happy. And that's maybe why I'm oblivious to men hitting on me. Cause I just, it doesn't register. I'm happy and I'm content and life's pretty good and going in the right direction. And I'm just going to keep trucking along because it's the first time in a long time where I'm just happy.
I love that. I love that. You know, it's interesting though, too, is like, I think there's a really important message here is that you don't necessarily need a ton of attention. Well, actually, no, you do need a ton of attention, but it's not necessarily just from men. You need to be in the spotlight. You're somebody who needs to shine. You are a bright star and you need to have people reflect that in you.
I do like being a little bit of a center of attention, I'm not going to lie.
You wouldn't be a lawyer and you wouldn't be in the courtroom if you didn't like to be on stage. I think we should start there. Yeah. I think you know two things. When you're a lawyer, you're on stage appealing to an audience. And when you're a judge, you're literally the boss and you're the most powerful person in the room.
You can't be a litigator, a true litigator, without some level of wanting to be the center of attention. You just can't, because it takes a certain level of chutzpah to get up and stand in front of people and say, you need to believe me, and here's why you need to believe me, and you need to do what I'm asking you to do. Like, that takes some, another expression, some cojones or some huevos. It just does. And that comes with a certain personality characteristic. It goes back to one of the things I've talked about before, is that just because you have narcissistic traits doesn't mean you're a narcissist, right? I mean, it doesn't. And I can assure you, about every high-level CEO has some narcissistic traits, because they wouldn't be where they are in their careers without some of those traits. And so, you know, when people say they overuse the term narcissist, because narcissist is a very specific clinical definition that you meet so many elements of the elements that create one, and it has to affect your life in a negative way. But just having some of the traits in some ways helps you get where you're going in life. Like, I have some of those narcissistic traits, and it's helped me get to where I am today. So I, you know, but that's why people have to be real careful when they start saying someone's a narcissist. Well, you know.
Well, I don't necessarily think you're a narcissist, but you are very full of yourself. And I will like to say this, is that if there's someone I would think of as the sort of pinnacle of egotistical, your name comes up in many conversations.
Oh,
so
there you go.
My thought is that for you, because it's best if I give you advice on how to conduct your life.
Correct.
At this point, I would say do things to sort of humble yourself, you know, maybe do things that will make you sort of a softer side, somebody who's less.
Are you telling me to become a wallflower, Jake? Is that what you're doing? I mean, maybe. Can you see me being like the sitting in the back of the room, being quiet and just going along to get along?
No. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I've identified in you, and this is all serious, is that your ego is a very interesting case study.
I'm a case study now.
You are a case study. You need a very strong ego to do what you do.
Yeah, you do.
Okay. And you also have a lot of humility, and you also have a lot of, let's say, in other ways, insecurities, things that you're working through, working out. But one of the things I noticed about you is that you are highly competitive, highly competitive. And so you conduct yourself basically like a professional athlete, someone who goes out there, does their work, does their performance, plays their game, and then afterwards sort of regroups, sort of strategizes, figuring out how to assemble and build and conduct themselves in a powerful way next time they go into that arena. That's really what you are, is a competitor. You are like a professional athlete.
Yeah, I don't like
out
to
there
lose.
In that way. It's, have you noticed that every trope that you mention, it's like winning or losing, go big or go home. Everything is based around competition with you. Everything.
You know, I never thought about that, but that may be right.
Think about it. Everything, like, it's like, I've got this sponsor. Who else has got this sponsor?
I don't do that.
I've got this podcast. Who else has got a podcast?
It's here. Let me show
they're,
you. How
they're
to get
they're
it
number done. Seven. I want to be number one.
Well, and then I go,
there's nothing wrong with that. I commend it. We need that energy. I'm not dumb. This is not a criticism. It's just a assessment.
The expressions I use is, instead of here, hold my beer, here, hold my keg.
yes.
And my keg, because it's like, let me show you how to get this done. Yeah. I didn't even think about it in the context of competition, but you're not necessarily wrong. Like, you've had surgeries. Oh, I've had surgeries. Let me top you.
Yeah, but you don't do it in that way. And there's people that do that where they have to be these sort of narcissistic, potentially focused on subject in these conversations. You don't have that quality. What you have is a way to identify and connect with people based on your own experiences. There's a difference in that. However, you are sometimes aggressively and outwardly competitive and inwardly competitive. Okay. You're your own worst critic, hands down. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. But I also think that when you get a seat at the table, what happens is that you try to see if you can get a better seat. It's all about seating with you. It's all about positioning. It's all about getting yourself into a position where you should excel. And you know ultimately that you deserve these things, but that competitive spirit is what's going to keep you thriving and get you in a position where you want to be, which is what you know you can be. But I think it's going to take, as it always is, many more people to tell you this, but probably not too many more, to be fair. I think you've been told yes quite a bit. Very few people like to say no to you.
Yeah, I don't like the word no. And if I get...
I'm the opposite, because I can do something with a no. Like, I can, like, okay, great. I respect the boundaries, but it makes me, like, if there's, like, a rejection when you're pitching something or whatever, then I'm like, well, how do I make this better? How do I go back to this? But you don't take things that
no.
way.
No.
The only no's you say is to yourself,
say no to myself,
by the way.
A lot. I think it comes down to, like, if I get told I can't do something, then I'm going to show you exactly how I can do it. Like, it's almost like, don't challenge me to tell me you can't do that. You won't succeed, or you're going to be a failure. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your energy. Don't waste your money. All right, no. I'm going to show you how this is done.
So I want to know, you're a woman who likes to get around in the awesome community.
Oh my God, that's the worst.
No, that's not a bad. What I meant was, you like to visit businesses. You like to be social. You're known in your community.
I guess my wording was suspect.
You get around, go around, you pop in and out of different locations, restaurants and bistros and boutiques and things like that. It's just, it's something that you do. You're well known in the Austin community. Let's be fair. Okay. You travel around. Is that more appropriate?
Travel around as opposed to get around is better use of words.
What could be worse than get around?
Passed,
like,
around.
I didn't say, oh, passed, she gets around.
That'd be worse.
Well, yeah, that was for the next segment, but I want to say this is that, when you're in these situations, okay, you have an opportunity to chat with people, connect with people. You know, you kind of bring a party wherever you go.
I do.
Bring a conversation. You're not somebody who enters or exits a room without having people talking.
Correct.
For better or worse. That being said, is how do you get people to subscribe to this podcast on their phones in the moment? We need to know.
I make them pull up either Spotify, Instagram, or their app, their podcast on Apple. Then I make them either grab their phone and look at my podcast and click subscribe, or I make them do it.
Define make them. This sounds like
a hostage situation
to me.
I'm like, hey, give me your phone. I'll pull it up for you. And then I click subscribe after I pull up the podcast and give it back to them.
But how does this even start? Like, what's the nucleus of the conversation?
So I can talk to anyone. You know this. Like, I mean, I can strike up a conversation with anyone. And I have a knack for people tell me things that I don't think they would tell normal people. But I mean, I really – well, I'm able to elicit stories that – like, my ex used to tell me. He's like, how did you get them to tell you that? I'm like, I don't know. I just talked to them. But really I can elicit stories. And I always have either my laptop with me, my iPad with me, cause I'm always, you know, multitasking, working. I got a lot going on. And so I always have cause I self promote, I have my Love, Lust, Law sticker on about everything I own. I'm seriously contemplating getting a vehicle and doing a wrap for it. So I always have that. And so that becomes a conversation starter. Like, oh, what's that? I'm like, oh, do you listen to podcasts? And then I go into, that's my podcast. And yeah, like, it's usually not hard for me to slip it in to the conversation at all. And in fact, my son, even when Manny, when he watches me do it, he's like, Mom, seriously? I'm like, yeah.
I find that charming, and I also find it effective because, you know, as we know, you have to get grassroots with this. Every podcast is about a listener. Every Yep. listener counts. Every listen counts. So that's a huge deal. And I think that, you know, even amplifying that, because there's a lot of people that would never have the gall to do that. But you do it like you're breathing.
Oh, it's second nature. my kids are like, seriously, Mom, where was I that I promoted it? I got the CBS investigators to listen and subscribe.
Who else could effectively do that?
But I did. I mean, I got the CBS women to listen.
So, Michelle, I usually listen to a lot of different podcasts, a lot of different shows. Last night, I happened to be going through the iHeartRadio app, and I actually heard you on True Crime Tonight. Hello. Can you share these things a little better? Can you promote them a little stronger? Because I didn't see any word. I just happened to come across it.
I'm a little bullshit, disappointed obviously. In your lack of involvement in my life. I really expected better at this point. All jokes aside.
Don't expect better because I'll only disappoint you. Trust me. I have a trail of disappointments in my past.
So, Jake, I was on True Crime Tonight with Stephanie, Courtney, and Body, and I had a fabulous time sitting down with those three amazing women on their radio show on iHeartRadio.
Now, we know this, and you know this. You're pretty impressive to strangers.
Rumor has it. I don't know why, but when it comes rumor to this.
But but people that know you really well don't give
they're
a
like,
shit.
That's Michelle.
So the question... I listened, and I know you pretty well. And I got to say, I was impressed. And I think the hosts were impressed, too. You really knew your stuff. You were well-studied, well-versed. You brought the heat. You brought some really disturbing details of cases. And you brought the laughs, too. So that was a really good balance in that capacity. And you're very respectful and somebody who I could see being a frequent guest commentator. And somebody who would be welcome into a show.
Well, I'm hopeful that my guest appearances with True Crime Tonight continue. And rumor has it they're bringing me back on next week because we really did have a good, informative, and enlightening conversation about the particular cases that we talked about in particular. But it was really, it was a new experience for me to be on a live radio show. I've not done that before. I've done TV. I've done, you know, pre-recorded stuff, but I've been live on TV. But it's my first live radio show. I thoroughly enjoyed it because I could be in my sweats and some yoga pants and not have to look camera ready.
I got to say, what I was probably most impressed by is how smoothly and effectively you handled a call-in, and you didn't know what this person was going to throw at you. Okay, somebody who had been dealing with an abusive situation, a domestic situation, and wanted your perspective when it comes to family court and what they're facing. So I was impressed by that because those are like these hardball things that you did not know what you were getting into. And that's some of the challenges and the joys of doing a live radio show.
I was not expecting to have a caller that I would have to answer. That came out of left field. That being said, if I can't answer questions in my arena, in my wheelhouse, especially being a family law litigator, then I probably shouldn't be a family law litigator because I have to think on the spot in court all day long. I mean, I have to be able to handle the tough questions or the hard questions, the questions out of left field. Because quite often I'll get a question from a judge. I'm like, let me think about the answer to that, judge. In order to do cross-examination, I have to be able to pivot and ask questions that I didn't necessarily anticipate because the answer that the witness gives me may be something that, wow, that wasn't on my bingo card for answers today. So it was really a great opportunity to help someone navigate a system that can be frustrating on its best days for the average layman to navigate. And so I hope that the advice I was able to give him was helpful and helped him get through what was really a tough situation for him. And we talked about the Colin Gray case in particular, who is the dad that was just convicted, I think, in Georgia for being responsible, I think, for a murder charge for his son's school shooting, where two teachers were killed and two students were killed. And we were talking about the case. And it was, for me, it was, they're like, well, what do you think about the liability extending to a parent? And for me, I'm like, well, it's kind of like the duh factor. It's, if you knew the history of this case, and I had done a deep dive on it, but this kid had school shooter photos from other school shooters on the wall in his bedroom. In addition to that, he had, the year before he did the school shooting, law enforcement had come out to his house, to dad's house, because the son apparently had made some kind of comments on Discord about a school shooting. So dad had a notice a year before. Dad also knew the child had mental health issues, but Dad still gave him like an AR-15 for Christmas. Okay. Then didn't lock it up. Mom, who had lost custody because Mom had, I think, drug and alcohol issues, called Dad and said, "Hey, I've got some concerns about him and what he's going to do. Please either don't give him a gun." Dad still gave him a gun. And then so Dad tries to pretend he's surprised that the kid went to a school and did something. I'm like, and then in addition to that, because the kid's issues, like Dad kept him out of school for an entire year. Like he didn't go to eighth grade because of the issues. And so it was, for me, it was like, well, duh, he should be held responsible, because it's at what point in the parenting do you get to escape just all liability? Like you have a duty to parent your children. And if you know, like he knew his son needed mental health treatment, didn't do it. In addition to that, he tried to get, like, he didn't put his kid in school. Like, how do you not put your kid in school? He had another child in the house that young girl was the younger sister of Cole. That younger sister was going to school, right? Like, but how do you not send your kid to eighth grade? How do you let your kid have school shooter photos up in his bedroom and think that's okay? It's the duh factor. Sometimes you look at the facts of a case and you're like, it's like, how can you not? It really is. So it's the duh factor. I think it was really informative, and it really gave me the opportunity to show like how you break a case down, like how you look at the facts and how that those facts go into the analysis of what a judge or jury may think, because I don't know that it's necessarily broken down in that same manner. And so for me, it was just, and it goes back to the duh factor. It's, for me, it was clear that that dad probably should have been held liable for, or guilty for what he was, for lack of bad parenting. And the one thing I talked about on the radio show was how quickly the jury came back in that particular case. Like the jury came back, I think, in under 2 hours, which means the jury didn't have any doubts that dad was guilty. And dad had like a 30 count indictment. And so I think dad's facing minimum 15 years to life in prison for what he was convicted of. So yeah, it was an interesting case. It's a sad case, but also, you know, it's easy to be a bad parent. It is difficult to be a good parent, because being a good parent takes an inordinate amount of work. And then if you throw in addition to being a good parent is difficult no matter what, you throw in co-parenting and not getting along on the same page with whoever it is you're as your co-parent because you're not in the same roof. Boy, you got a whole bunch of other issues that you got to deal with.
Such a tragic story on so many levels. And I think that you, as a judge, former judge, and as a family law attorney, really understands the dynamics of cases like this more than many people, because you see a lot of things when it comes to abuse and neglect and things in your court. So I can only imagine that you have presided over hundreds, if not thousands, of cases at this point. And I know we've discussed a few of them, but have you had a case that you presided over that was ruled, let's say, a certain way with you as an attorney in the court, and you knew that not only should it not have been ruled that way, but you knew there was high potential for some catastrophe to happen and there's literally nothing you can do?
I remember a case in particular. There was a newborn baby. Baby was under 3 months old. And there had been an incident where mom left this child to go, I think, on an alcohol run, right? Like left a newborn baby by herself to go on an alcohol run. And there was a little bit more to the story. Like it was pretty horrific what she had done. And CPS left the child with mom, so long as grandma was supervising. And there were enough of the facts of the case that when I heard it, I turned to the CPS person that was in court. And because they weren't asking me to change anything, and I didn't have the ability to change anything given what was going on in the proceeding before me that particular time and day. And so I turned to CPS and I said, when something happens to that baby, I said, not if, when something happens to that baby, that is on y'all. Because, I mean, I was very clear in my thought on what they had done. And I know the CPS agent came back to my court probably a couple of weeks later. And he talked to me. He said, thank you, Judge. He's like, after what you had said to me in court, we went back and relooked at the case and removed the child.
That is incredible. I've been talking about this show, but is there any way we could listen to it?
We could, and I think we have one queued up, but we can listen to my explanation in my own voice as opposed to you recounting it for us.
Welcome back to True Crime Tonight on iHeartRadio. We're talking true crime all the time. I'm Stephanie Leidecker here with Courtney Armstrong and Body Movin'. And we have the most extraordinary guest. We have a judge, a former judge in the house, also an attorney who specializes in family law. And if anybody has dealt with family law in any way, you know how hard it is. It's a really complicated system. It varies from state to state. And we've been covering so many cases really quite recently where family dynamics are so in play, or breakups or domestic violence. And, you know, we get these questions quite a bit. So, Michelle Locke, welcome. We're so happy that you're here. You know, worth noting that Michelle specifically is out of Austin, Texas, but she's here to answer any questions. Should you have any, if you're going through a split or you're headed to family court, and feel free to call us 888-31-CRIME, because, you know, look, Michelle, we talked about this, you know, when we first met, the statistics are pretty staggering. When there's domestic violence, for example, and, you know, one person in the relationship makes the decision to leave, that is the most, you know, really dangerous time. And it's typically women, but definitely men as well. But, you know, for women, it's the most dangerous time in a person's life when you're actually making that decision to exit a potentially very dangerous relationship. And I know for many, leaving your kids and the parenting and upsetting the children, that's all so much a piece of it. And I hear it all the time. And we cover so many cases where they're like, well, the judge might not believe me, or they don't know the story. And I have a sneaking suspicion that Michelle Locke can see through all of it. So we're so happy to have you here to just shed some insight. And for anyone who's going through these scary times, just know that it's going to be okay. And Michelle is the person to direct any questions to. So welcome.
Okay. I have one question, Michelle. And that is, can we actually call you Michelle in the presence of a judge? I want to say, Madam Judge, Michelle Locke.
I want to say, Your Honor.
Madam, yeah. Secretary.
No,
yeah, sounds so important.
Y'all, I'm just Michelle. I know one of the things when I became a judge, and I became a judge the first time at 31.
Oh,
I was sure that the black robe would never affect me because I didn't want to lose who I was as a person to what we sometimes refer to as the black robe-itis. I have a firm belief in life that we all bleed red, we're all the same, and that we all have different roles in this world to serve. And whatever that role is doesn't mean we are any better or any less than any other person. So please, I am just Michelle.
I'm not just Michelle. You're no. Judge Michelle.
Yeah. I can somehow see the TV show already.
Right.
Well, oh, yeah, goodness. It's a complicated thing. So where should we begin? We know you've seen so much, and certainly in your own courtroom and as an attorney. And, you know, listen, in our own lives, we see this real time, whether personally or with friends. It's such an aggravating element when mom and dad are, you know, breaking up or at each other's throats. And when we all say, oh, I take a bullet for my child, but yet you can't be in the same room with their parent, you know, like it's tough.
It's an impossible situation. Where there is love, there is divorce. There are breakups. That's just the reality of it. You look at the statistics, 50% of first marriages end in divorce. And I think the statistics only get higher for every subsequent marriage after that. You add in stepkids and other dynamics, and it is made for disaster, whether well-intentioned or not. And the kids are the ones that end up suffering. And what the parents who are engaged in this, like, just lockdown war don't realize that these children didn't ask to be born into the situation. They didn't ask to have two parents not get along in the way that they do. They didn't ask for it. And so a lot of times, even just my own clients, I tell them, like, look, y'all are adults. Deal with your stuff, but let the kids have their Christmases. Let them have their Halloweens. Let them have their birthday parties where both of you can suck it up and attend so that the kids don't suffer, because it's their childhood and their memories that you're destroying. yours may already been bad. Don't create another generation of it. Put it aside. We're all grown up.
Well right. said.
Well, very well said. Go ahead.
During your time on the bench, so can you explain sort of some of the biggest warning signs that you've seen in custody disputes, particularly before things maybe escalated into violence?
So I'm going to tell you, number one is substance abuse. I can't tell you how often in domestic violence cases, there are one or two items involved. One is alcohol and two is cocaine. And I can tell you about 80% of cases involve some kind of alcohol, cocaine. The other one is steroids, believe it or not.
Wow.
That's also the one that causes anger occasionally in the people that use the steroids.
Roid rage, right?
And that's so, what they call it. No, it's a thing. It's a thing. Yeah. And so really, there's a multitude of things that judges will look at, even attorneys when we analyze the cases. But it's drug use, it's alcohol use, steroid use, any kind of behavior that's outside the relative norm. One thing I know I always listen for when I was a judge, and I warn my clients about this too, is never refer to your child as my, because one, they're not a possession. And two, unless it was immaculate conception, it took two. So that's usually when people start making children possessions in court, usually a warning sign.
So substance abuse and possessiveness, right? Those would be a couple of warning signs. So for people who might not understand how like the system, like the big bad system works, what actually triggers like CPS, Child Protective Services, to remove a child from the home?
Great question.
That's a great question. It really is. I was for a period of time a CPS judge. And so I saw and actually signed the affidavits and the temporary restraining orders or the temporary takeout orders that would pull kids from homes. Whoa. And it's a really, really, really high standard, particularly in Texas. I would assume it's about the same everywhere else because you're removing someone's child from their home. And so the allegations have to be pretty severe, and it has to be that if the child's in imminent danger. So they're witnessing, one of the reasons CPS removes a lot is domestic violence. If domestic violence is occurring in front of the child, that is quite often grounds for CPS to step in. Law enforcement will quite often flag to CPS, hey, y'all need to go check out this case. If you've got major addiction issues, then you've got medical providers that are under obligation and mandatory reporters that have to report to CPS. Right. And so what other people tend to forget are that most professionals are mandatory reporters. Even as a lawyer, I'm a mandatory reporter. And if I don't report suspected child abuse or suspected elder abuse, I can have my license in trouble. And so when you've got anyone that runs into a family that sees the potential for a child to be in danger, then those professionals are under an obligation. As teachers, counselors, principals, your dentist, your eye doctor. Like if you're going into your eye doctor and your child's got two black eyes and a broken orbital socket, I can about assure you that eye doctor is going to call CPS.
You know, I didn't know a lot of that.
Yeah. And so people think, well, how does CPS get involved? Oftentimes they get involved without you being involved in them getting involved. And it's almost always a professional. That's why you will find that CPS investigations increase when school comes back into session.
Because teachers, right? Teachers and our mandated reporters. And they spend so much time with our kids, right? They spend so much time with our kids outside of the home.
They do.
They're probably the number one people that, and that's why, remember we were talking about that one case where the kid was getting homeschooled and they didn't even know she was missing.
Melody Buzzard. We talked about her earlier. Right. Yeah, Melody Buzzard, who lost her life.
Right. And, you know, homeschooling is a way to you know, basically not come in contact with mandated reporters. Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we get this so often too, because again, people reach out, you know, they're in need or they're in crisis or they're afraid for their safety and they don't want to leave their kids or their pets and they don't have a lot of resources to go anywhere. So, you know, look, whoever has the cash kind of, you know, holds the purse a little bit in terms of who's calling the shots sometimes and certainly who can pay for an attorney, right?
Right.
And that gets really troubling. And I'm just going to say, oh, in a woman's case, but of course this happens for men as well. Sure. So we're being very clear here. This is not just, you know, dads versus moms, but what I can speak to anecdotally is, you know, as a mom, you would never would want your child's consistent daily life to be disrupted, right? You don't want to disappoint the little framework that your job is to set out to keep them safe in the world and, you know, take the hit should you have to. What do you suggest for people who are maybe a little bit out of cash or don't have the resources to pay for a very, pay for an attorney is so expensive these days and they need help and they need to get out of a abusive relationship, not only for themselves, but for the safety of their kids. Is there a step one? Is there a hotline? Like, what would you recommend?
Oh, God, hotline, probably not. But this one will tell you, if you're a victim of domestic violence, about everywhere in the country have either the criminal prosecuting office or county attorney's, district attorney's office provide protective orders for free. And so if you are a victim of domestic violence, you can call your local and literally, if anyone has a phone, just Google, where do I get a protective order in my county or my city? And it'll give you the information of where you can go get one. You can go to your local library if you don't have access to a cell phone. You can go to your local library and do the same thing on the Google there, and it'll give you who you can call. And that is free. There are also lots of free legal services, ones for victims of domestic violence specifically. Mm. I know in Austin, we've got volunteer legal services where attorneys like me donate our time to help people that need and can't afford services. And so the services are there. You just have to have the courage to call and reach out, which sometimes is the scariest
part
of it. And what I often tell people that are victims is, you think your kids are safe where they're at because you somehow control the environment. But the reality is they're not, because they're witnessing what will stay with them forever. And the beautiful part about children is they are resilient. And so you get them in a safe place. You get them in a place where they know mom is safe, because don't think for a second those kids don't know what's going on and the realities of it. But you get them in a place where they feel safe and they know mom is safe or no dad is safe, whoever the victim is. It's amazing how much better they start doing. Because peace, it's such a cliche, peace is priceless, but Lord have mercy, it is.
So well said.
Oh, man. So here's a tough question, it seems to me. How do judges sort of balance protecting children while also respecting parental rights in these complicated cases?
That's a good one.
Oh,
it's hard.
It's
so hard.
It's a hard one. It's hard. We have a constitutional right to parent our children, whether that's good parenting or bad parenting. Anyone that's divorced will know that they can't help the bad parenting that their co-parent does, that they want to or not. A lot of people stay married because they think they can control more of their children's environment as opposed to if they go to dads or moms on the weekend. That being said, I know there were cases that I lost sleep over with regards to removing the children, not removing the children. But y'all, there are some cases that are so clear cut on removing the kids that it's a no-brainer. I mean, there are some cases that the abuse is astonishing. I mean, these children are used as ashtrays for their parents to put out cigarettes. I had one case where there was a year-old baby that weighed 16 pounds. They're horrific cases. And so in some circumstances, it's real easy. It's real easy. Mm-hmm. And other ones, it's not so much so. But I would like to say that, y'all, CPS is a miserable job. Worst of the worst. And they see these innocent, sweet babies who have broken arm fractures that are healing, broken rib fractures that are healing, a broken orbital socket that's healing. The stuff that you see is just horrific. And thank goodness we have the good people. But y'all, CPS is just like any other human, just like judges. They sometimes get it wrong. And I know I've told CPS from the bench, I'm like, when something happens to that baby, because you all didn't remove it and left it with that mother, that's on you. And on that particular case, I think CPS went back in and looked at the case and said, yeah, the judge may be right on this one. Sometimes you just got to follow your gut instinct.
It is a last resort though to remove children from the home, right? Like sure. But again, if it's clear, I think that it's not so hard, right? Like it's easy to do.
It's easy to do when it's clear.
Yeah.
Like the kids still love their parents, even if they're abusive. Sometimes kids still love them. So I'm sure you must hear such mixed messages. So hard.
Of course they do. Of course they do. Yeah.
This is all complicated. And we are so happy that you are here, Judge Michelle Locke. And stick around because Michelle will be sticking around. We're going to take a little look into the Colin Gray school shooting case. And also the question of parental responsibility. And if you have any questions for Judge Michelle Locke, give us a call, 888-31-CRIME. We'd love to hear them. Keep it here, True Crime Tonight. We're talking true crime all the time.
Thank you for joining me on today's episode of Love, Lust, Raw. Want to reach out? Want to find out more what's going on with me? You can follow me on Instagram at Attorney Michelle Locke. You can also email me at hello@michellelocke.com. Just remember, Michelle is spelled with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, with no T for that.